Hi, good people. Hi. Good to see you all. I'm glad we get to have this unique spread of folks here today. Thank you for our children's story Oscar, because it leads us right into the opening of our ancient words this week. And we find ourselves in the book of Luke, chapter 19, verse 28, if you want to follow along. Jesus is preparing to enter into the city of Jerusalem, and there are some things that happen before we actually get into this long, weary week that Jesus has ahead of him. Next Thursday, if you have been kind of keeping along with our Bible reading plan and or just your local calendar, what is traditionally known by most scholars and religious traditions is the Passion Week, which here at La Sierra, we are going to gather for 4 days right here in the sanctuary and 4 different nights. And we are going to be walking through the last 4 days of the life of Jesus, just before his death on the cross and then the resurrection. But today, before we actually bulldoze headfirst into this crucifixion scene, which I think we often do because we're so anxious about this good news, how it brings the gospel alive for us in a completely different way, before we bulldoze into that, I'm going to ask us to take a moment to pause and go on this thought journey and reflect on this scene just before Jesus actually rides into Jerusalem. And we seek what one of the other readings from our Bible plan reading from Psalm 118, give thanks to the Lord for God's love endures forever. The psalmist is claiming that there's this ever-enduring love of God that is present. So we're gonna see in this one scene, where can we find that? So Luke sets the stage for us. Jesus has come from a long time traveling, and he's been working alongside the disciples, apostles, there's probably Pharisees mixed in the remix, and in every city that they get to, and every time he speaks, there are more people gathering and coming onto his group, and so he's got this massive movement of people moving throughout. And so they now come to the city, and Jesus give some instruction to the disciples, two disciples, it says, that you go to the cities, Bethphage or Bethany, this Mount of Olives we know, because this was the place where Jesus taught the disciples to pray, and then it turns out it will also be the last time and the last place that Jesus will pray with his disciples. So a quite memorable place. And they are instructed, like we heard in the children's story, to go into this town and to untie a donkey. Yes, the answer is yes, right? So these disciples have been working with Jesus, and that Jesus also specifies in particular that this particular colt, this donkey, has never been ridden before. And then, as the prophetic Jesus does, he gives them instructions, if this happens, which he means this will happen to you, so here you are equipped to attend to this. If somebody asks you, what are you doing? Then you say to them, this is for our Lord, and our Lord needs it. In the Greek, for what is identified as the master of the donkey, it is translated into the Lord of the donkey, right? This master of the donkey is Lord. And so we have this moment in which Jesus is also attending to, let me help you remember who I am, the true Lord for you. And so we have these disciples, and they go and they attend to this. And as I read this passage over this week and these last couple of weeks, something that stood out to me specifically was this really specific instruction of Jesus and this caveat about this colt, right? Who, a colt, by the way, is not an adult donkey. It is technically a baby donkey or a young one. Under the age of 4, and it's never been ridden before. So it is considered a wild creature. And I thought, what a curious distinction that we find in all 4 of the Gospels, right? So there's something about this particular recording of happening that has meaning. So as I thought of this passage and what I thought about, okay, every time I think about this passage, the things that I remember off the top of my head, well, usually this topic is preached and the donkey's highlight is this is probably the ultimate and the greatest humbling humility gesture of Jesus, right, on his part. In complete contrast to kings who in that day rode in probably on these beautifully groomed horses, so actual horses, full-size horses, right? And then they probably came in on these thoughtful processionals with a band, if you will, and people dressed up. And Jesus, on the other hand, rides in on the ultimate lower class animal that is usually used to work, to pull things, to hustle in the workplace, right? So this picture, for me usually, kind of brings up this glowy, mystical picture that I can think of as far as the late 90s. And usually I get this picture in my head, and I'm like, yes, this is probably from movies that you probably saw in the 90s of the life of Jesus, right? And everyone in this scene, interestingly enough, seems to be pretty serene, you know, just, we're so glad we're here. Or excited, right? You see some people who are so excited, or the women are excited here, you know. And even the donkey, who doesn't really have an expression, isn't excited, but isn't not excited, right? And so we have this entire scene, and all of it is fascinating until you think, well, what about the context of the current time? The condition of the society at that time. Rome was this powerful source at that time, and the people who surrounded Jesus generally were people who needed so much to be liberated from this grasp of Rome and this societal unbalance in the world where the rich grew richer and the poor really grew poorer. And so Roman imperialism is at an all-time high, except for you look at these pictures, and that's not there, right? So in the midst of this thought process of the week, I believe there was a divine moment in my office in which there was a different creature that crossed my path. And this is what this creature looks like. That is called a Milo. And this little guy was crawling all over our office earlier this week, but it was a little bit more like a baby stampede, okay? Because Milo, he is probably the cutest and the cuddliest baby you have ever known. Like, when you think about baby folds and baby rolls, it's Milo, right? There you go. And we compared him once to the Michelin Man, and he was really close, right? So this guy right here, being this soft and cuddly creature, he's actually a tank, right? Like, if you feel Marnie's muscles, she is this solid athlete just by carrying her child, right? And while he's physically strong, and we watch this and we witness this as he bulldozes through the office and nothing gets in his way, especially now that he's learning to walk, what we also are noticing is that Milo also has a sharp personality. And he is absorbing information all of the time, everything that's happening around him. And he doesn't quite have the ability to articulate in language, but he is absorbing everything 100 miles a minute. And this moment with this ridiculously adorable baby, which, by the way, his mom calls a baby bull, so true. In his innocence, there is actually more to Milo and to children that we actually give them credit for. And so I wondered, how is these two moments, this young child in their innocence and this young colt in its young stage, how is this a snapshot of Jesus opening up a greater picture of God's love for God's people? So the donkey, who in this picture that we saw before looks so well-behaved and domesticated, was not exactly mentioned for the purpose of modeling submission to Jesus. This isn't one of those passages. And yet, there's this bold declaration that this creature, who has never been ridden before, does arrive at the foot of Jesus and allows for Jesus to ride on his back. Perhaps the first one. So to be honest, I didn't think much about these creatures before, not before this passage. I usually kind of remember donkeys to be these kind of silly creatures that you see that are usually stubborn and they uncooperative. They don't, you know, they do what they want, kind of like in the Disney production Shrek. Do you remember that one? And so I did what people naturally do when they're trying to learn about something new, is I found the Google search button. And I typed, "Are baby donkeys dangerous?" And I just thought this was gonna be really funny. And it turns out the answer is yes and. And so donkeys are actually these underestimated creatures that, unlike horses, they're in the same family. You know, horses are fierce in size and in stature. They're these big creatures, but horses are actually, they're calm and they're non-confrontational. And then donkeys, on the other hand, small and stocky, they are these creatures that are quite confrontational. One blogger who raises donkeys and horses commented that a wild donkey is probably more dangerous than any wild stallion that you'll run into. I'd not heard this before either, right? So I'm just completely oblivious. So again, in my intrigue to understand these creatures, I did what else you do. You consult your local expert in the area. For me, it's Maggie Woosley. Do you guys know Maggie Woosley? She usually sits like right around over here. So if you ever have questions about horses or donkey creatures, she is your gal. And so I called Maggie, and after a short conversation, Maggie confirmed for me that yes, indeed, wild, untamed, never-before-ridden donkeys can be severely dangerous. Because donkeys, they're physically strong, and they're also strong-willed. And they, on the other hand, are confrontational creatures. And when put in these unknown and potentially threatening situations, they run headfirst to the target. They're gonna get straight at you. And they will use their legs to kick you, and they will pull out their teeth and do other things for you, right? I don't know if we had a picture of a cuddly, cute donkey. This is what we usually think, like, right? How fluffy, I'd like to touch you. But they can be pretty scary, right? So this was kind of an interesting thing to learn. And then if we follow these patterns of Jesus, so going back to our story after our side learning of these creatures, the author of Luke maintains, and he looks at these patterns that Jesus, these behaviors of patterns throughout his ministry, and Luke maintained a focus on this untamed and wild, undomesticated creature profile throughout his ministry. So this wasn't new to Jesus. In fact, it was the untamed, the socially outcast, the wild, the undomesticated, if you will, people that Jesus attended to and ministered throughout his life. And perhaps the reason that these people responded to Jesus was because in Jesus they found that love that wasn't offered to them anywhere else, because it was a kind of love that would overcome these social stigmas that we're used to, these boxed-in ideas of how we should behave, right? But from Jesus, no, they would find this untamed, wild, and undomesticated love from God. And for those who would respond to this from Jesus, then they too would witness this love from God, and they would realize that not only were they worth dying on a cross for, this foreshadow for the week to follow, but even more significant, that they were worth living for. And especially in the midst of such deep societal turmoil, probably death was a better option than living in the circumstances. This I learned in a different way, that sometimes death is a more exciting option. When I was an RA, a residential assistant at the university a long time ago in my undergrad, and every year we got new students, you know, and every year you got to hear new stories about people from different backgrounds. And one year, there was this gal that we got pretty close. And she used to call me like one of her big sisters, she said, or a big sister. And I said, I could do that. I'm a big sister already. I know exactly how to big sister. And so we got to know this gal. And for the most part, I knew that she had some trouble in her life. But I never knew quite the extent of the pain in her life until one time, late one night when I was away from the dorm, I got a phone call from her that she was weeping, and what she was trying to tell me was that she was sitting there and she had attempted to take her own life. And that somehow in this moment between digging into her veins with this razor, something told her to stop. And as I raced from my car and in my car trying to get to her house, you know, we partnered with a different friend and that friend got there. We tried to clean her up and stay with her until we could get her help early the next morning. As I stayed the night with her to keep watch, I learned as she went in and out of sleep that for years and years she had experienced this abuse from somebody in her family. And that when she tried to open up to her family, instead of embracing her and welcoming her and trying to find her help, her family ridiculed her and they shamed her for exposing their family. How could she bring this shame on them? And she was in so much pain all of the time that her life, it was so much more complicated and hurtful to be alive than not to be. Death to her was a way of silencing the chaos, if you will, that the world had offered over and over again as the only option to her. So for her, and like so many of us sometimes, I think that we experience this kind of loud chaos, and it gets thick and loud for us, and we kind of forget this declaration from the psalmist that says we are beautifully and wonderfully made by this God who doesn't just want to be with us, God needs us. And sometimes we simply need to hear that we're worth living for, right? And through Jesus, God reveals that God chooses this love over and over again and breathes life into a world that is constantly experiencing chaos. So God's people, yes, the answer is yes, are worth dying for. But even more remarkable is that God says, you are worth living for. And we will get to this, right? We will experience the death of Jesus. But over and over, God will choose, even after in the midst of a chaotic death and timeline, God will come back to life to abide with God's people. This messy, chaotic, often undomesticated condition of the human life. But not because of who we are, but because of God's character of love. I've been reading this book, John Steinbeck, for you literature junkies, The Pearl. Sometimes it's considered a little bit of a parable, so if you've read that, I think the Academy students have read it because I got it from there. And it tells about this poor diver, and I was thinking about how this story really often tells us something significant of this story as well, of this poor diver and his family and generations of generations that have tried to gather pearls from these gulf beds in the Gulf of Mexico. And for many years, they have been struggling to keep up with the needs of their family. And so the main character, his name is Kino, and his wife is Juana. And they have this young baby whose name is Coyotito, which means little coyote. And the needs of this family start to grow, right? For those of you who used to be just two of you, so either single or just a couple, you know that when you had your first child, oh, now you have to really share your food, right? Now your time has to be expanded in all of these other ways, and now you have to clean, and now you have to cook things, and now you have to attend to things that before you didn't really have to, right? And so the needs of these families are stretched, and now it's at an all-time high, the stress. And under this anxious pressure, Kino works really hard, and his hope is that I will find something that will finally get us out of this rut, that it will change our lives forever. And then one day, it happens. Deep down in the sea, it says, Kino finds this large pearl, larger than they had ever seen recorded, right? And then this little town finds out, and everybody is excited for Kino and Juana and Coyotito because this is their ticket out of this poverty that they've all lived in, and they will celebrate it because at least one of them gets to move on and gets a different chance at a different life. And so what will they do with this pearl? And then Kino and some of the divers go, and they follow this family, and they go to see what they can get in exchange for this pearl, and they go to get it appraised, right? And the first man that they meet says, well, I'll give you $1,000 for it. And Kino is infuriated. I mean, he feels like he's been taken advantage of. This isn't worth $1,000, he says to him. And he feels like so many times before, generations in the past have taken advantage of the poor here who probably they think don't know any better. And so Kino tells him, no, this is worth $50,000, not $1,000. And then the dealer tells Kino, well, this pearl is like fool's gold, right? And who would buy it? Who would give you more than I would give you? There is no market for such things. And then he says to him, this is curiosity only, he says to him. I'm sorry. You probably thought that this thing was of value, but it's just curiosity. And Kino pauses for a second, almost as if he's got to question his value. And maybe this guy is right. Maybe he has a point. Maybe this is something that has no value. And then he snaps out of it because his need for his life and for his family is greater than this one moment of doubt. And he rejects the dealer's assessment. And he says, this is the pearl of the world, he says to the dealer. And the dealer shrugs his shoulders and he says, listen, on the contrary, it's large and it's clumsy, a curiosity. It's an interest, and maybe a museum will take it from you and they'll add it to their collection of seashells, right? And with great disappointment, Kino, he is not having this. He is not going to receive this. And so he says no, and he walks away. And as he starts to walk away, the dealer says, wait, listen, you think that I'm trying to take advantage of you, but I'm going to show you that I'm not. So I'm going to call a few other dealers from down the way. I'm not going to tell them how much I offered you, and I'm going to have them come and assess your pearl. And so they come, and they assess his pearl, and they give him this appraisal. And they also look at him, and they go, this is not the real thing. People wouldn't buy this. And one man says to him, I'll give you $500 for it. And of course, Kino, infuriated, if I wasn't going to take $1,000, why in the world would I take $500, right? Okay, I won't spoil the ending for you, but it does get really intense. Kino decides, you know what? I'm going to take this to the capital. You can take your $1,000 and your $500, and I'm going to take this to the capital where somebody will really understand how much this is worth, and they will give me more, right? And so he goes, and as he's walking away, the dealers look at themselves, and they realize, we need what he has. And so, as the story unfolds, Juana and Kino have to run for their lives to protect this valuable thing that now that they have valued, other people have seen this value. And during one of the scenes, after all of this turmoil that is exhausting to run away with your wife and your child and attend to the needs of this growing family, and Juana, exhausted, says to Kino, well, maybe all of it is an illusion. Maybe these guys were right, and maybe this pearl has no value. And then Kino responds with a very similar look that he gave to the dealers. No, he says to her. They would not have tried to steal it from me if it didn't have value. I think that God's love is relentless in the way that Kino learns to be relentless with this love for this pearl. And God will go to all lengths and risk for all of God's people. And when in the chaos of the world, it tries to speak doubt into our lives the way that these dealers try to speak doubt into the lives of Kino and his wife about their worth and about our worth and whatever it could mean for us, sometimes It's through struggling relationships, right? Doubt comes and it's deep-seated in struggling relationships. Sometimes we see it in the failing of health, our own health, or the failing of health of other people. Sometimes we see it through addiction, or we mask it through addiction. Sometimes it comes in this practice of self-loathing. Or maybe it's masked in feeling of being stuck. Like it's 2016 and you kind of thought you were going to be somewhere else, but you're not. You're here, right? Or maybe you're like Kino and Juana. Maybe you're like Kino and Juana and you have this family to care for and you don't have the means to do it, but it still exists. The world speaks into our life that maybe God as creator and the love that God has for creation is an illusion. And then God cries out against the world and through the presence of Jesus says no and speaks hope, life, back into existence, into our life. I like the way that John Ortberg puts it. He says, the reason every person has great worth for Jesus is that every person is loved by God and has bestowed worth. We have bestowed worth from God, and there is nothing that the world can say or do that will change that. Maybe distract us, but what is this fact of Christ and the love of God? That is unchanging. So Jesus, choosing to ride on this undomesticated donkey, reveals to us that God's love is to something that is raw. It's determined to win out the atrophy that is constantly happening in the world. And God will go to great lengths for God's creation. God's love cannot be domesticated. Not into the world that figures however it tries to make sense of it. This entire God story is actually bookended, right? With this love from this fierce God who calls all things into existence in Genesis. And again, at the end of this story, it may be this different kind of unconventional love we've not seen before, but it is creative in ways that we could possibly not imagine. So unlike stories that we have been told, and sometimes these stories come from ourselves, right? Or sometimes these stories of being unfit and unqualified, or they come from our own communities, from our families, from our intimate friends, that we need to come prim and proper. We need to be these stallions for God. Or we experience rejection from the world. Author Iaconelli describes it in his book, Messy Spirituality. Rejection is a paralyzing experience of disapproval, repudiation, exclusion, ostracism, and sometimes it even happens in the world of religion. And religion is really good at doing rejection. Like it was during the time of Jesus. Rejection, it keeps people at an arm's length, and it stamps us with this stamp of loser, wherever it is. But lucky for us, as Iaconelli suggests, that Jesus is drawn to the rejected because they are these prime candidates for spirituality. Jesus doesn't focus on the immediate diagnosis of the world on the people, no, or the local community, but God attends to each of us individually, and then God attends to us as a community. And even though we are these messy creatures who are still trying to navigate life, we are worth the fight, God says. And through Jesus, we will take this risk. And though we know the end of this story, it will kill Jesus. God's love is even greater and more daring and says, I am back and I will live one more time. I will live again with my people. I will be present. So, as you are preparing this next week for this Passion Week, and you are remembering these last days of Jesus, remember that it's the life of Jesus before the cross and the life of Jesus after the cross that redeems each and every creature to this holy love of God, where it was disconnected and tempted to atrophy, now is reconnected to its life source, its creator. And this week, may you bring all of your unpolished, stubborn as a donkey, untamed and wild longings and or insecurities, wherever they may come from, to Jesus. And recognize that he needs them, because Jesus is Lord. They don't belong to you, Master. They belong to Jesus, Lord, so that you and I may be restored, bestowed, re-bestowed with our value. And when we have arrived at this, that we walk into the following week and the following weeks as these people in the city did. Maybe they had something that they had realized, that if the people didn't cry out, the rest of the world would cry out. And so they chose, we will celebrate. We will be this processional. And may you follow this unconventional, undomesticated, relentless, ever-loving man on the most unlikely creature that's never been ridden before, your life. Amen.